Everybody, and welcome to A Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin. My guest for both hours of the program today is Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. If you have any questions you'd like to ask Justice Steigman, you can call us at 356-9397, or you can send us a text message at 351-5357. Well, Bob, nice to see you again. I'm glad that you're on here. I guess this is our will be our last one that we began. We were trying to figure that out back in 1980 around.
I think it was 1981. I'm not sure. So 36 years and counting. And it's been a real pleasure and honor to be doing this with you, Jim. And I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Well, we've had some wonderful shows. You always come packed with a lot of good things to talk about. I have my own list that I put together, and callers oftentimes, as they do on most of the Penny shows, rule the roost, because we want to take as many calls as we can on as many topics as they have. So let us begin. We're at 356-9397. The text line is 351-5357. Any questions or comments for Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman? I want to ask you about the what's being called the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. This, as I understand it, and you can explain it if you would allow people that are licensed to carry concealed carry weapons in one state to carry them anywhere else. This is already passed the House and described as the NRA's favorite gun rights expansion bill, and the anti-gun people are up for grabs about this, and I guess there's some questions about the constitutionality of it, et cetera.
Well, it's an interesting concept. it's based on the notion that if someone has a concealed carry permit, it ought to be dealt with like a driver's license. So when we cross state boundaries, we don't have to worry about whether our Illinois driver's license will be valid in Indiana or valid in Florida or anywhere else in the nation. The idea is that, as with the driver's license, if someone has gone through the training in a given state and going through the processes necessary to get a concealed carry license so they can carry a gun, they should be able to travel from state X to state Y and not worry about are the rules different, so that if they have a gun in their car, it's no longer legitimate there, whereas it is in the state in which they got the permit, in which they live. And part of the problem is there are some people who, this is in the East Coast in particular, I think in one state have been entirely lawful in carrying a gun and have gone into another state and been stopped for a minor traffic matter, and the gun was not quite the same under the same circumstances. The rules were different. And you'd think, well, there's a problem of prosecutorial discretion. You'd think people would have the good sense to say, well, this guy isn't a criminal, and he's caught in the fact that there's difference here between our state and the state in which he came from, in which his possession of that gun would have been perfectly legal. And they were actually charged with a crime, and it's an expensive, embarrassing, and difficult proposition. that's what it's about. And it's an interesting question, however, whether this is something which is justiciable, that is capable of being addressed and rendered by Congress. For instance, the driver's license, I'm no expert on this, but my understanding is this is a driver's license compact among the states. Let's say if you are from Tennessee and you're in compliance with the laws there, your driver's license in Tennessee is good here in Illinois. But that's the various states have agreed to this, and it's not a question of Congress, I think, even being involved, much less requiring it. Right. So this is a new concept. The argument, however, is, based upon the Second Amendment, that there's a constitutional right to be a concealed carry. That is, you've got the right to keep and bear arms. And as I've mentioned before in this discussion about arms, there can be reasonable regulation about this. You can't have a howitzer, but you can have a gun under certain circumstances. But if you have complied with those requirements in your given state, shouldn't this be viewed as a constitutional right you have to carry your weapon into some other states and to have it there? I'm not sure. This is one of those, you know, I've had this conversation with Jim Dye. One of those areas where I think both sides can make a pretty good argument, and I'd like to see briefs on it if I were a judge or if I were a member of Congress, think, is this an appropriate area to exercise federal control? Now, most conservatives are very hesitant, like me, about the federal government getting into new areas. As for instance, I think we should, and we're long overdue, to abolish the 21-year age as a requirement for alcohol purchase nationwide. Now, the federal government did that with the carrot and stick approach. That is, they said, if you want any federal highway money, you're going to have to raise your drinking age to 21. I've been pushing for a long time that we should get rid of that because it's an infringement upon states' rights. That is, the states should be trusted to figure out for themselves what should be the drinking age in Illinois without the wisdom of the folks in Washington. So this might be another problematic area. I don't know. I understand the arguments, and I'd like to see how it plays out.
Could the states, some states, get together on this and have an agreement as the one you just described with regard to a driver's license?
I think it's an excellent question, Jim, and my guess would be, yes, they could. But the problem is you might then still have a patchwork of states. So if
you could have 10 states that had agreed on it, but you wouldn't know which ones necessarily.
That's right. So if you're driving from here to Florida, let's say, and you go through first Indiana, it would be okay, but maybe Tennessee wouldn't, and so forth. So it would be kind of tricky, and it would be a step towards solving the problem, but it would still not be the same as our driver's license situation, which is what the proponents of this bill want to do.
So this is going to have to be something that the Congress passes.
Right. Then.
Well, that's so the House has already done it, evidently. Right?
Well, my guess is they might have trouble passing it in the Senate, but even if they do, I think there's a legitimate constitutional question as to whether or not the states can be forced by Congress to do this, and it'll be interesting to see the briefing on it.
We're visiting with Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. We're at 356-9397. And our text line here is 3515-357. How many of you are gun owners? We've talked about concealed carry and NRA and those kinds of topics for a real long time now. If you have any comments you would like to make about this proposed Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, what they are calling it, so give us a call. I've got a couple of others, and we'll see what you've got on your list there. But
sure.
I noticed in the Tribune this morning, they're calling this a code of silence payout in Chicago, amounting to $20 million, $10 million to each of the two people involved, the two young men that were killed. What happens is that the city has decided to pay the families of two young men killed in a drunken driving crash. This was caused by an off-duty policeman. It was revealed that key documents involving an alcohol-fueled bar fight that the policeman had in the past improperly withheld by the lawyers that were working for the city. So this deal ups the tab for misconduct judgments in 2 months in Chicago to $100 million.
Well,
now,
we
before you get into that one, let's see what the other callers have to say. Maybe
sure.
They're back on the other topic. Who knows? But we don't care. We'll go in any direction. Tony is first. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
Hello, Tony.
Hello. Hello.
Well, don't tell me we're going to do this again. I will see if it was that line or if it's all the lines. Let's go to try J.D. Are you there, J.D.?
I am.
Phone problems at the moment. So let's take a break, Ed, if we could. Then we'll come back and see if we can find out what's wrong there and continue with Bob Stegman. This is Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin with Appellate Court Justice Robert Stegman. Having a little difficulty with our phones, so we'll just continue on here. I had mentioned to you this code of silence payout from the city of Chicago, and you started to talk about that. I tried to take
yes.
the calls and weren't able to get those on, so why don't we just go back to that?
Sounds good. It's a disturbing story. I've worked with the police and the criminal justice system for almost 50 years. And there is a sense that some officers have that they want to rally around one of their own when he's attacked. And I can understand that. But at the same time, police officers have a duty to be honest and forthright and forthcoming. And it's one thing to want to make sure that one of your colleagues who is under attack for one reason or another has his story told and is properly defended and gets it out there and is not subject to an unfair attack in the media. But it's another thing to withhold information, to not provide information, to, even worse, provide deceptive and false information, which is one of the things, excuse me, up in Chicago, this Laquan McDonald case that everyone is familiar with, the guy who was shot 16 times by a police officer who's now on trial for first-degree murder. One of the really disturbing things about that, if true, is that there are several other police officers around whose reports corroborated the report of the shooter that, oh, this guy turned around and confronted me and I felt in fear of my life, when the video showed none of that was true at all. This is a very disturbing business, and I can understand it, but the police have to do better than this. And I like to think that this code of silence, and it's more than a code of silence, as the Laquan McDonald case demonstrates, it's a quote of sometimes misrepresentation and lying to protect one of your own, which is even worse. I think this is primarily a big city phenomenon. I've been involved with, as I say, police, criminal justice system in Cook County and down here as well. I held court in Cook County over 11 years and hearing cases up there and spending a lot of time with prosecutors and police and obviously down here too, where I was, in addition to a judge, been a prosecutor. And I think our local police, the downstate police, do better. Now, it's interesting to explain why. Some people would say, well, we're just better folk and all that. I'm not sure. I'd like to think maybe that's the case. But the real problem in Cook County is anonymity. If you got 14,000 police officers, it's hard to figure out who did what and hold anyone accountable. Whereas here in Champaign, it's our largest police department, 100 and some officers, I think, you develop a reputation. You have your own reputation, and people would know. And if you misbehave on the street, or if you're having a problem with your behavior, I think it would come out. So I think the message for downstaters is, when you see these stories about Cook County and the code of silence and misrepresentations by police and really some awful stuff, there was a guy who was just convicted, a police officer in federal court, for shaking down or shooting drug dealers, and just terrible stuff. Read it with the sense that this is very unlikely to occur or to represent what's going on with our local police down here, because it really isn't.
Well, this sounded like it was the city lawyers that were holding back the information.
That's even, in a sense, worse, because lawyers have a special duty to their officers of the court, and to withhold information or lie about it or to be less than candid, that's the kind of stuff that could pull their ticket, so to speak, get them suspended or from the practice of law, or maybe even disbarred.
Let's try the phones again. J.D., are you there?
I am here, Jim.
Well, you are the you're the one that can handle these phones. The rest of us can't. I'm glad you're here. What's on your mind today?
Well, actually, we strung a piece of string and two tin cans, so it's working this morning.
Yes, indeed. We got to make sure we got a strong string there.
What I want to talk about just for a moment is that national reciprocity on concealed carry.
Okay.
If you have a concealed carry permit in Florida, it's recognized in 28 different states, and it looks to me like all they're trying to do is make it uniformly throughout the country. So if I have a concealed carry permit in Illinois and one in Florida, I can drive all the way to Florida, and all the states down going down there will have that reciprocity with Florida. Of course, Illinois doesn't have reciprocity with anybody. But if you have a Florida license, you've got 28 states you can carry in and not have a problem.
Well, I didn't know that. Thank you, J.D., for mentioning it. Is this through state compacts that this is occurring?
Well, you know, the states are scattered, so I don't know how Florida did that or the other states did it. But once you get your Florida concealed carry, you can carry in 28 different states, and if you're stopped, that's not the problem of your having a concealed carry. So, I mean, doesn't it make sense that they'd try to do that nationwide?
Well, it does, and it gives me an opportunity to mention one other thing. I remember when concealed carry first really became a thing, so to speak. It was about 20-some years ago in the 90s and early 90s, and I remember the Aginners saying it's going to be Dodge City. We're going to have people and gunfights at the OK Corral all over, and it's going to be terrible. And it turns out, as I predicted, because I knew people who were involved with guns, turns out that the people who have concealed carry licenses are the single most law-abiding element of a given state's population. Even more so, there are fewer crimes being committed by these people than there are by sworn police officers. So I just want to, so the listeners remember, and they still hear Mike Madigan and Rahm Emanuel and all the others about guns are the cause of our problem and concealed carry is so awful. Just try to remember what they said 25 years ago and how wrong they were then. They're equally wrong now.
All right.
Well, I read someplace that for a state that has concealed carry, their violent crime rates are down, I mean, down 10 or 11% less than the national average. So when gun opponents come out with, and typically it's more emotional than facts, but it seems to me like the facts are on the side of concealed carry.
Yep, I think you're right.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. Thanks,
Jim.
Thank you, J.D. It is 9:28. We're visiting with Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. Just wanted to bring up one quick one for you. We talked about it a little bit off the air, but there was a, speaking of Florida, there was a pizza delivery man shot a guy that was trying to rob him. I don't know if the pizza man had a concealed carry permit or not, but he had a gun anyway.
Well, he might have, and that's one of the good reasons why a concealed carry is a good idea. It can provide a deterrent to people who are of a mind to hold folks up. And the idea, if someone is committing or attempting to commit a forcible felony upon you, a felony involving the risk of death or great bodily harm, such as pulling a gun, say, giving you your money, you may use force, including deadly force in self-defense, and pull out your own gun and shoot them. And as far as I'm concerned, that's just desserts. Good for the guy. And what's important, and by the way, this is particularly important with regard to women who are subject to being sexually assaulted. I think it's a terrific thing for them to take classes and have a concealed carry permit, because there is some sense that this woman, in the eyes of some potential sexual assaulter, this woman he's thinking about assaulting might look weak and all that, but does she have, is she carrying in her purse? That might give him some pause.
And by the way, the robber, or the would-be robber, was treated at a hospital and charged with armed robbery, and no charges against the pizza man.
Works for me. That's exactly how it should be.
We have several callers waiting, but it is time for the news headlines with Brian Barnhart. So callers, hold on. We'll come right back after the news and continue here. Here is Brian. I'm Jim Turpin, back with the Public Justice, Robert Steigman. We go to the phones for Bill. Hello, Bill.
Morning. A quick comment and a question for the justice.
Okay.
I once heard, and it could have been you, Justice, but I once heard somebody say the West wasn't wild because people carried guns. People carried guns because the West was wild.
Well,
the question is,
I don't think I said it, but I agree with it.
Okay. Question is, I've read in different places where it was suggested that people in Illinois, since they don't, I don't think they recognize other states concealed carry, but if you get a permit from another state, that would allow people who travel, say they got one in Florida, then there would be 28 states where they would have the permit. Do you happen to know if you are allowed to issue out a concealed carry permits to out-of-state citizens?
You mean, do the authorities in Florida issue permits, a Florida permit to people in Illinois?
Yeah.
I think they, actually, it's an excellent question. I think the answer is yes, but I'm not sure. That is, if you're an Illinois resident and you wish to go to Florida, let's say, as a snowbird and stay there for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, maybe even during the winter, and you want to get a concealed carry permit, I think you can, but I'm not totally sure. You'd have to contact the Florida authorities. That way you would be able to, you wouldn't have to worry about reciprocity issues.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And Don is next. Hello, Don.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Well, we're going to get a tax cut. We're going to get a tax cut that'll show up in February, and ISIS is done. That's huge news. Go Trump. I mean, the news just won't report that ISIS is over because of Trump. It's all because of Trump is why they won't report it.
Well, if you watch CNN, they'd say ISIS who?
Right. Well, I mean, it don't even get reported locally around here on our news. You know, I'm sure it don't get reported all around the country, no matter where you go. But I was calling, how does a prominent attorney like Lisa Bloom get caught giving Trump's accusers money to accuse him, and all the brainiacs can't figure out whether she committed a crime or not? I'm not sure how that happened.
Well, actually, it works this way. It would be arguably a crime if what these accusers were saying about him wasn't true. But if someone is willing to step forward and says, gee, I'm going to be slandered. I'm going to have all these other problems. I don't know, make it worth my while. Let's assume for the moment it's true, and she's kept quiet all these years. I don't think there's anything that would be illegal about having someone saying, okay, well, step forward and I'll help you out financially. Now, that's based on the presumption it's true. If it's not true, we're in a different area.
Well, okay, so it's based on the accusation itself, not whether it's true or not.
Well, no, with the idea, the assumption is it's true. Let's assume. Pardon?
I think who is it? The FSC. I might be wrong on that, but you can't tell me they allow that to happen for somebody to pay, for a lawyer to pay an accuser for accusing. That's not illegal.
Well, I think if it's true, I'm not sure it's illegal. It's at least in a gray area. If you're absolutely correct, if you're paying someone to assert something which is not true, I think it's an entirely different area, especially if you know it's not true.
Let's go to the phones for Danny. Hello, Danny.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I am a resident of Illinois, and I do have a Florida concealed carry. About the only place I can't use it is in Illinois.
Well, thank you for letting us know that. So you applied to Florida authorities and got one?
Yes, I did. We had classes at a local gun club, and they accepted my application. So Merry Christmas to both of you, and Happy Hanukkah, and et cetera, et cetera.
Thank
Goodbye
you, sir.
Now.
So in Florida, as we've learned this morning, they've got some kind of a reciprocity going with 20 some states, but
not Illinois.
But not Illinois. I mean, well, and who knows what else? I mean, we don't know. You might know who, if you have the concealed carry, maybe they give you a list of the other states. But otherwise, you wouldn't know. And there are people that don't have a concealed carry that don't know which states do and which states do not at this point.
I think that's true, but I suspect Florida, being a state that, as opposed to Illinois, that is not viscerally opposed to the idea of concealed carry and guns, will probably provide you with a list upon requesting. It must be remembered, we were the last state in the union dragged kicking and screaming into having concealed carry because Mike Madigan and Rahm Emanuel and all the others said, it's so bad, and, you know, it's going to affect our ability to regulate guns, which, as we know, is working so well in Chicago. That's why there's no crime up there.
Working very well in Chicago. The numbers there are staggering.
Yes, they are.
Let's go to Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
What's up, Laura?
I'm addressing an earlier question about someone in Illinois, maybe a snowbird or a vacationer, who's if they're able to get a Florida concealed carry license. The answer is very much yes, and has been for years.
Good.
My husband and I, when my family was down there for vacation a few years ago, took a 2-day course in concealed carry in their the laws in Florida. They had us do shooting tests, they fingerprinted us, and they gave us concealed carry license that back then were good for 11 different states, reciprocity. It wasn't 28 then, but even then, they definitely allowed people from out of state to sign up for it.
You remember whether they gave you a list of the other states in which it would be you could be used?
They did. It was only 11 back then. Mm-hmm. It was a few years ago. It wasn't 27. But yeah, they did indeed give us a list at the time. Mm-hmm. And those are now, I think, available on the internet as well.
I bet they are.
The different states have reciprocity ones.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you, Laura. Appreciate the good information. Anna Wall is next. Hello, Anna Wall.
Well, good morning, and it is a pleasure always to hear Judge Steigerman.
Well, good morning to you, Anna Walt.
I said, it is a pleasure to hear you, because as a former sociology teacher, you are not oblivious to the sociological factors involved in the criminal arena. And I wish that you had had time to read the article in the News Gazette today on officials briefed on racial research and see, and the comment. I'd like to have your opinion on that garbage that is being taught to students at the University of Illinois. But anyway, I remember one time that what impressed me the most was when I heard you talking about cultural differences. It's in the performance of crime. It seems that some of the teachers at the University of Illinois are completely oblivious to that. And that's what I had to say. I think you're a wonderful judge, and I wish we had more like you.
Well, thank you, Annabelle, and I appreciate your kind remarks.
Thank you, Annabelle. Bob, here's a story that just came in. It says the Sangamon County coroner announced the death of Judge John Schmidt this morning. Coroner Cindy Evans said that Schmidt passed away just after 4 a.m. Tuesday morning at Memorial Hospital Center emergency room. He was 52 years old. Edward says at the time of his death, it was presumed to be from natural causes. There is no evidence of foul play. An autopsy is scheduled for later this morning. I assume you knew him.
He was my newest colleague in the appellate court. It's a real shame. A wonderful guy. And he had been Sangamon County State's Attorney for several terms. Then he was a circuit judge and a very distinguished guy. And we had my colleague Tom Appleton from Sangamon County retired December 6th, effective December 6th, from the appellate court. And Rita Garman recommended in the Supreme Court appointed John Schmidt to fill his vacancy. And I've known John for a long time, and I thought this was a wonderful selection by Justice Garman, and it bespoke of a terrific addition to my court. We have seven judges on the Fourth District Appellate Court, and it's a real shame, and it's terrible business. I'll just mention this about it. John Schmidt was always overweight. He was always a fat guy. And we had a court party. His first day was December 6th, the day of Tom Appleton's retirement. He's been a member of our court for literally a week. And we had our pictures taken and all that. And I remember commenting to my wife at the time that he'd really become obese. And I was concerned about him because I knew he was in his early 50s. But he was, if you list things that you are bad as far as your health and all that, being really obese is one of them. And it's still a real shock, but it serves as a reminder. I mean, everything was coming up roses for this guy. He being on the appellate court is an absolute blessing, the best job in the world, which is why I'm just started my 41st year on the bench. December 6th was the anniversary of my being sworn in.
And no retirement in sight.
Well, it's, you know, the joke, it's a little less funny at this point, is my retirement plans are when the EMT says we can't revive him. But that's because it's such a wonderful job. It's such an honor and a privilege to serve as a judge.
So you'll have a vacancy now that needs to be filled again.
Yes, and Justice Garman did a wonderful job in selecting John Schmidt, and also in selecting, we had another vacancy when Carol Pope retired this summer, Judge Craig DeArmond from Danville. These are terrific people who are terrific additions to the court. It's such a terrible thing for John. I mean, he was like a kid in the candy shop. This is the culmination of what he'd been working for. He was a law geek like me. And if you're a law geek, the appellate court is really a wonderful place to be. And I talked to him. We were excited for him. And it's just such a shame. It's a terrible business, terrible loss for him and his family. It's truly a loss for the people of the state of Illinois who would have been well served by John Schmidt on the appellate court for many years.
So he basically didn't get to work yet before he died.
A week.
Right?
He'd been, week. Yeah, I've already gotten a few drafts from him and talked to him about a few cases, but it serves as a reminder, and you know, and I'm sure it was natural causes and a heart attack. He was just he was fat and out of shape, and as wonderful guy as he was, it serves as a reminder what we hear from our doctors is really true, that you know, and I was just thinking about it as I heard the news this morning. I was at the gym yesterday lifting weights, and I tell people, I really don't like this. But then again, I look around, I'm going to be 73 next week, and there aren't many septuagenarians in the gym. And I think of all the people who maybe would want to do it now, but can't. So I think I probably ought not complain and just do it. And it's part of, I hope to live a long life at this and take advantage of this wonderful job that I'm blessed with.
We'll take a break here at 9:51 and come right back. Phone lines open at 356-9397. Text us at 351-5357. Back after this. This is Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin with Justice Robert Steigman. Talked about a variety of things, had some real good calls. We'll continue up until 11 o'clock this morning. If you have something on your mind, just give us a call. What's on your big list over there, Justice Steigman? I know it's a little, we've got 4 or 5 minutes. Have you got something that we can cover in a short period of time?
Well, yes.
He always has a lot of...
I got a bunch of stuff. The first thing is...
Stack of stuff.
Talk right, about immigration issues. And one of the things that I always want to emphasize is when you're looking for bias in the media... One measure of it is the, I think, intentional conflation of immigration, legal immigration, with illegal immigration. So if someone is concerned about or against illegal immigration, you're against immigrants. You're against all these people who are coming just to make their lives better. And I think it's an outrage to think that I'm against immigration because I don't like illegal immigration. I use the term, pardon the expression, illegal aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, since my father was a legal immigrant who went through Ellis Island and did it the right way. And here are the questions, you know, for years, and I found these notes in my materials that I've been raising on this show. And two fundamental questions regarding immigration. First is, should this nation have any restrictions concerning who may come here to live? Now, pausing right there, I remember it must be 10 years or more that I raised this point, this question, and I remember some people saying, you're crazy. How could anyone object to that? Well, I said at the time there are some people out there who do object, and we see more and more of it all the time now, who say, no, there shouldn't be any restrictions at all. But assuming the answer to the first question is yes, should we have any restrictions, then the second question is, should those be restrictions be enforced? And there are lots of people who say, well, we should have them, but they really shouldn't be enforced. You know, I guess it's just to make ourselves feel
like a lot of other things we have.
Yeah. And and the DREAM Act, for instance, that everyone talks about, it should be emphasized again. The DREAM Act was something that... President Obama did, and he didn't have the constitutional authority to do it. It's a matter where Congress has to change this. His deferred action for whatever it stands for, DACA. But how do I know that the president didn't have the authority to do it? Well, I can cite that renowned constitutional scholar, Barack Obama, who 27 times during his presidency said to Latino and Hispanic groups, I know you want me to do this as president, but I don't have the constitutional authority, until he woke up one morning and he did. Now, I woke up that same morning, Jim, and, you know, I checked the Constitution.
It hadn't changed.
Nothing had changed. And what's interesting, again, you talk about media bias. I've yet to see, maybe I missed it, but I don't think so. I've yet to see CNN or any of these other networks ask then President Obama, or even now. You know, President Obama, you said 27 times you didn't have the authority, and then one day you did. What changed? Where did this authority come from? You'd think they'd do it. In fact, President Trump has it exactly right. This is not something which a president can or should do. This is something for Congress. Congress should, if they wish to have legislation to permit this, let's pass it. And I think we could probably come up with some agreement on some of these people who were brought to this country as infants or toddlers by illegal immigrants. Let's see if we can address this. At the same time, I think the business about amnesty is very problematic. I don't like it. We saw what happened with amnesty under Ronald Reagan. We promised that the borders would be enforced, and it didn't happen.
All right, we can get back on that the second hour if you'd like, but our time is up this first hour. It is indeed 10 o'clock, and we'll come back right after that with Justice Steigman on DWS in Champaign-Urbana. Welcome back to hour number two of A Penny for Your Thoughts. My guest is Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. Tomorrow, Jim Dye at 10 o'clock, and then on Thursday, Julia Reitz at 9 o'clock. On Friday, we have a special program planned featuring a lot of singers and performers and some familiar music and some interviews of past guests and so forth, all aimed at having some fun on my last day here on Penny. Today, we're talking about the law. We're taking your calls at 356-9397. The Castle Heating and Cooling text line is 351-5857. I'm sorry, 5357. Said that enough times, I should know it, right? 351-5357. Well, Bob Steigman, since you were here last, the president of the University of Illinois, Mr. Killeen, said that we're tired of this disruption of meetings and people that are boycotting certain things because of the speakers they don't like. And we're putting a stop to that at the University of Illinois. And it was a very similar speech that the president of the University of Chicago had given some time ago, a month ago or so. And at that time, I believe he said, simple enough, we're just going to arrest them. Now, Killeen didn't say that, but at least I guess my feeling is, okay, we've said it, let's do it.
That's exactly right. I I prefer to be optimistic, and I want to commend President Killeen and the other people from the University of Illinois who have come up with this policy. It's a wonderful first step, and here's some of the things he said. The President Killeen said the UI will encourage the centers to counter speech they do not accept, but will not condone shouting down or physically obstructing or threatening a speech or the speaker's audience, explaining such activities are antithetical to the primary value on which freedom of speech rests, a commitment to the power of ideas, rather than use of force to influence the way people think and act. I say it's a wonderful first step because what's missing is the threat. Namely, it's wonderful to say we're not going to tolerate the heckler's veto, where hecklers disrupt or cause a speech to not be heard or
to have a speaker not come.
This is all terrific, to say that we're not going to do it. But what I want to see from Chancellor Jones and President Killeen is the next step, actually two next steps. First is to say, and if you violate these norms, we're going to punish you. If you're a student, you're going to be suspended or expelled. And if you're a faculty member or a staff member, as we had just recently, you're going to be fired. And then the next step is when it happens, that I fear it will, they do it. In other words, this is a good first step, and I hope that we can take President Killeen and Chancellor Jones at their words, that they finally understand that this business about words with which I disagree constitutes violence, which is what these demonstrators say, is nonsense. I mean, let's just call it what it is. It's nonsense. We're not going to tolerate it. The answer to speech with which we disagree is more speech. So the university's taken a good step here. I fear, I'm confident, I regret to say, that we will have more instances where the embarrassment of the governor of the state of Illinois is shouted down and not permitted to speak. All those people should have been arrested. And anyone who is a student should have been expelled, suspended, some academic action taken, and people who are staff members should have been fired, or faculty members should discipline and maybe put them on a track to be fired with their tenure stuff. But that's the step we have to now take to show we're serious.
And the one that really got me was these protesters that stopped the homecoming parade and stopped the chancellor's car. The chancellor basically is in charge of the police on the campus, and it was his car that was stopped, and not much happened.
Well, that's right. And I will cut him some slack by saying maybe he didn't see this coming, though I think maybe he should have. But also, we hadn't put out this policy yet at that point. And I think the question is, the next time something like this happens, will Chancellor Jones, who's in charge of the university police, say, I want these people arrested. This is interfering with our rights and with the University of Illinois. They have no right to do this. So I'd like them to be arrested, as opposed to just stop the parade, which was the coward's way out, frankly.
Well, they when they stop the parade, is that not breaking the law?
Of course it is. One of the problems here, and Chancellor Jones brings a lot of strengths to his position. He, you know, man of science, and I think he's a solid guy in many ways for this. But one of the problems with so many of the university administrators is they're in fundamental agreement with the mission, the statement of the demonstrators. I think if this had been a demonstration, for instance, of pro-chief people who'd stopped the parade, saying, we're not going to let you proceed until you say good things about Chief Oladewek, my guess is Chancellor Jones would have not greeted their disruption with the same kid gloves.
All right. We're at 356-9397. Do you have any comments on that? And we can talk about some other First Amendment things here in a moment. I just wanted to see what this text message said. It says, Google CCW, and you can get all the states where you can carry and not carry. And Jack says, states that recognize Illinois concealed carry license are 27 states that Illinois recognizes. And or you can get the app CCW. It's free, according to Ernie. So we had quite a conversation going about the concealed carry and at the beginning of the program, in case you are just joining us. Any other First Amendment things you have going?
Well, no.
Where do you want to go?
Well, other than just to point out, the First Amendment is always under attack. It's the crown jewel of our Constitution. No other nation in the world has it, which is why they tolerate abuses on freedom of speech literally everywhere else that our First Amendment protects. But, as we see, there are people in this nation who say, oh, we ought to be like the enlightened Europeans who wouldn't allow for what they call hate speech, which is speech with which they disagree. And we need to be eternally vigilant to protect this precious jewel. But I, you know, the other thing, I'd be happy to, there's this, just a week ago, racial disparity in traffic stops, which
okay,
I'd like to address.
I'll get into that here in,
okay.
Just a moment. Mark Coombs
Thank
has
you.
Joined us on the line. Hello, Mark.
Well, Jim, how you doing today?
Fine.
Good morning, Mark.
Jim, I wanted to call you, and your daughter called me the other day. Thank you, Ed. Your daughter called me the other day, and I wanted to call and congratulate you and just tell you how much, how many great memories we had together and how great you were for us in our basketball program when I was there.
You know, thank you, Mark. I was saying the other day, somebody was asking me about players and coaches, you know, how did you get to know them? What kind of people are they and all those kind of things? And I said, for me, it was basketball because you got to travel with the team. You slept in the same hotels. You occasionally, when invited, had meals with the team. You got to know all the guys. And I got to know people like you, and I can recall the two of us having some wonderful conversations many, many times.
Well, we did. On the planes, on the buses, in the hotels, on the courts. I mean, we had a great time together. It was a highlight of Illinois basketball at the time, and just tremendous memories. And congratulations to you, Jim. And I just wanted to express that to you.
How's Coach Henson doing? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's doing better. He had some issues and was in ICU for several days, but I think that he's doing better now.
He's still in the hospital.
I talked to him yesterday.
Still in the hospital, I believe, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still in the hospital.
Well,
so,
Mark, it was awfully kind of you to call, and we'll get together and rehash some of those old times.
Okay, Jim, and give my best to Bob, too.
I will do that.
Thank you, Mark.
He's right here.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, Bob, it was really hard to leave Champaign-Urbana. All the good things that we had going on getting together and going to the pizza places and talking sports. My last 5 years in Champaign were fantastic.
Well, we miss you, Mark. Whenever you're back, we'd like to have you join us.
I will. Thank you very much, guys. And Jim, you had a great, great career. Congratulations to you. And you added so much to our program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's go to Frank.
Hello?
Yes, Frank. I lost my voice there. Frank, go ahead.
Yeah, you got talking about reciprocity with guns. What about, could the judge talk a little bit about reciprocity with the pension systems? Aren't judges, teachers, legislators and so forth allowed to, if they they change pension systems, to transfer their credits from one to the other?
Yes, I'm no expert on it, but I think the way it works, it's intrastate. That is, it's only within Illinois, as opposed to if you are, as far as I understand it anyway, if you are, let's say, a teacher and you move to Tennessee or Kentucky or something, I don't know that any of your pension would travel with you, any of your availability. But within the state of Illinois, there are certain movements where you can have your pension move with you. I think, as a, for instance, people who were elected state's attorneys and then get on the bench, which is a fairly common occurrence in the state of Illinois, I think have credits for their service as state's attorney that reduces the time they have to be as a judge in order to be eligible for a pension as a judge. I think the same thing works with members of the General Assembly, and there are some other different positions within the state on how this works. It's all matter, by the way, of legislation. Whatever the General Assembly provides with regard to this, that's how it works. But I'm no expert on it.
So, for example, say a teacher went back to school and become a judge. Could a teacher transfer their credits to the judge's retirement system or vice versa?
I don't believe so. I don't think that's the case. I think well, in part because there are lots of teachers, lots more teachers, let's say, than there are state's attorneys. But My understanding is it's a limited area being able to move pensions. But as I mentioned, I caution you and listeners, this is hardly my area of expertise. I haven't really paid that much attention to it.
Okay, sorry. One more thing.
Sure.
There was a caller on your last appearance on Penny for Your Thoughts that talked to you, or you talked about petition in court to not participate in the judge's retirement system. Why was that, and what case was that?
That was a long time ago. Back when I first, and the way it works, by the way, if you're elected a judge, you're automatically a participant in the judicial retirement system unless you opt out within 30 days. Back in 1976, believe it or not, 41 years ago, I took office as a judge. And back then, I discovered after I was a member of the system that there was a problem, because what would happen is I was paying 11% of my income into the judge's retirement system, which is a significant amount. But what made it worse is I was paying tax on it, and then it was taken away, and I never saw it. They changed the rules in the the early 80s, I think, so that it's now deferred income. They would take it out from my income to put in my pension, but I wasn't paying taxed federal and state taxes on this 11%, so that made it a lot better. And I lost my effort to get out anyway, but that's why I was doing it like in 1979.
All right, Frank, thanks. We appreciate your call. We need to take a quick break here. We're coming right back with Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. It is 10:28. We'll be looking for the news headlines here in just a little bit, Bob. But go ahead with whatever you had there.
Well, after news, I want to discuss it further. But there was an article in the News Gazette just a week ago about a band of officials searching for cause, talking about the cause of racial disparity in New City data among the Urbana Police Department with regard to the stopping of cars by the police. And it's black folks being stopped. It's a percentage that's consistently higher, said the article, than for other racial groups. And they're wondering, gee, this is a problem. What's going on here? And the implication, as I want to get into after the news break, is that because more blacks are being stopped than their percentage of the population, that is proof, and all the proof that's needed, that there's bias in the act of the police in stopping these people. I want to pursue that a little bit after the news.
All right, we'll do that. It is now 10:30, and Brian Barnard has the news headlines. We'll be back after that, and we'll take it right up until 11 o'clock this morning with Justice Robert Steigman. Welcome back to Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin. My guest is Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. Go right up until 11 o'clock. If you'd like to be on the show, you can call us at 356-9397. The Castle Heating and the Cooling text line is 351-5357. Talking about the bragging rights game there, you get any confidence that we're going to be able to beat that Missouri team? They are really loaded this year, and they got a new coach, and got some of our players.
Yes, they look good. On the other hand, the Illini are a team that's hard to evaluate. Which team will show up at which point. The team that gets down 15 points early on doesn't look like it beat anyone, but sometimes they really play well.
Just two halves of two different halves in that last game.
I think that's right.
You were saying before before the break.
Yeah, this was just a week ago. The band officials search for cause of racial disparity and stops by police. And a couple quick observations. First of all, you know, I've been driving cars for a long time, too. And I asked the police officer about just the other day. I don't know about you, Jim, but when I'm driving behind a car or I see a car go, I can't tell the race of the driver. And particularly at night, it's hard to even tell how many people are in the car, much less the race. And a presumption behind this is apparently the cops are choosing to stop more black people than white. And I think this is a questionable presumption just empirically. How can you tell, number one? But aside from that, this whole business about racial disparity in stops is the same thing we've been talking about and reading about with regard to racial disparities in the criminal justice system, why there's so many more black people in jail or in prisons than their percentage of the population. And the fundamental claim, without anything else, is to just look at the numbers. If blacks are 13% of the population and they constitute 60%, let's say, it might be, I don't know, of the population of the Champaign County Jail or the prisons, that is all the evidence we need to show that there is prejudice and in the system and the blacks aren't being treated fairly or not, there wouldn't be this racial disparity. As I've said repeatedly, first of all, I reject this. I've been in the criminal justice system almost 50 years. I reject it. I think the system holds people accountable for what they do, notwithstanding what the race may be. But the best example of this, to show that this statistical claim is bogus, is to ask about the question of women. Women constitute a majority of the people in this community and pretty much everywhere else, 51%, I think, by most standards. The very day that this article came out, December 5, I checked with the Champaign County Jail to find out what percentage of the people in jail are women. And it turns out there are 158 people in the Champaign County Jail, and the total female population was 25. So I think that comes down to 15%. So here's the point. There's this vast disparity among the sexes. Women constitute a majority, yet they're only 15% of the people in the Champaign County Jail. There's one of two explanations. Either the criminal justice system is unfair, is giving women a pass for all the crimes they're committing, because the premise being sexes like races commit crimes in the same numbers without regard to differences, or maybe women are committing fewer crimes. Now, between those two, you can take your choices. I think it's the latter. But the point to people who claim that there's a racial disparity in the criminal justice system based solely upon these numbers, and I've made this request before, call me up. Let's talk about it right now on why that difference in numbers justifies your claim there's racial disparity in the criminal justice system against blacks, but there's no sexual disparity against men, because women, far less than their numbers in the population, are not being jailed.
You've talked about this before, some time ago.
Oh, yes.
And has anyone challenged you on your...
Never. Never. That's why I'm saying it again. Let's put it out. By the way, there's this wonderful economist, Thomas Sowell, who I like to quote, who explains this. Because you talk about, maybe it's that blacks are committing more crimes and there's a problem. Why is that the case? And this is a sociological phenomenon. Thomas Sowell is a black economist who's been a brilliant guy and written a lot of books and whatnot. And a lot of the explanations for this, assuming that it's a problem among blacks, is the claim, and I'm sure you've heard it, that slavery destroyed the black family, and that's the problem, and we have to be generous and understand the difficulties that black families are now engaging because of that. It's a residue of slavery. And Thomas Sowell, the black economist, points out this is bunk. And these are a couple of points he makes. I have them here in front of me. Going back 100 years, when blacks were just one generation out of slavery, we find that the census data of that era showed that a slightly higher percentage of black adults had married than white adults. And he adds this: the black family survived centuries of slavery and generations of Jim Crow, but it has disintegrated in the wake of the liberals' expansion of the welfare state. Then he added this as well. A vastly expanded welfare state in the 1960s destroyed the black family, which had survived centuries of slavery and generations of racial oppression. In 1960, before the expansion of the welfare state, before the war and poverty of Lyndon Johnson, 22% of black children were raised with only one parent. By 1985, 67% of black children were raised with either one parent or no parents. And he adds the following, is a big favor. The Obama administration was offering blacks an exemption from school behavior rules that led to a rate of disciplining of black male students that is greater than the rate of disciplining of other categories of students. And he says, this does no favors. They give black youngsters exemptions from behavioral standards. It's a bad thing to do. And he adds this, which I think is an important point that I've also made here. This is not ultimately a racial thing. That is, the problem is the family disintegration. Exactly the same welfare state policies and the same non-judgmental exemption, Sowell adds, from behavioral standards in Britain have led to remarkably similar results among lower class whites there. So this is a, as I discussed here as well, a function of family disintegration. I think that's why we have the behaviors we do. One other point I want to add in this. We have all these sociological graduate students and people who can study things. What I'd like to see them study, and no one, and I've called on this, by the way, at least 15 years. We have prisons filled with folks, black folks, who are there because of they took out guns and shot at people. I'd like to have a study saying, in effect, ask them, why did you do that? Why did you think it was appropriate in that moment to take out a gun and shoot at somebody to and maybe hit them and kill them? This is a cultural matter. You know, when people say guns cause crimes, I say, yeah, guns cause crimes like matches cause arson. It's not the guns. It's the people who have them. Why was there this thinking on the part of these folks that this was an appropriate way to behave as opposed to Pike County, Illinois, where there are lots more guns than there are even in the south side of Chicago, and there are no gun crimes?
Let's. I think we have a couple of people here that want to talk about that. Let's go to Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you, sir?
Good morning.
I'm doing good. Hello, Jim. Hello, Bob. Very good to talk to you.
Good.
I have two things, and then I'll get off and listen. First of all, my daughter is an Urbana police officer, and she, and I just wanted to back up what Bob is saying. She has said almost quote verbatim that when you pull a car over, especially at night, you can't tell a thing about the people that are in the car. You can tell nothing until you walk up on the car, and that's why they walk up so cautiously, is because they can't tell anything about the people in the car.
Yeah, they don't know what's going. They don't know what's going to happen either. Somebody.
That's exactly right. You know, she says that these single, you know, other than like a standoff or something like that, the greatest risk that they face is walking up onto a car that they don't know anything about. The second thing I had is a question for Bob. Being that you're a judge, my own personal perspective on concealed carry is that I think, seeing that we have these no zones, I think that there should be no place that you should not be able to carry except for psych wards or psych hospitals and prisons.
Well, I agree. I think this is, my daughter came up with a wonderful phrase. She calls it magical thinking that I really like a lot. That is, it's magical thinking to say that, and I see it here at the News Gazette, so we have no guns allowed here. Well, by God, the guy who's going to come in here and was going to shoot up the place and commit murder, he sees that sign, he says, well, I guess I can't do that. See, so, of course, the effect is that anyone inside who might have a gun, a concealed carry, and use it for self-defense, kind of like these church shootings or other shootings where you can't carry concealed carry, The law-abiding citizen is deprived of the opportunity to defend himself or herself. So the point being, it's magical thinking that somehow a sign like that is going to keep the wrongdoer out while the law-abiding citizens abide by it.
So, and it's greater risk the person is going to carry the gun in there and shoot people up. It's much greater risk that they are not going to accomplish their goal because there's somebody in there that will pull the gun on them and shoot them before they can accomplish their goal. So what's the use?
Of course. And I think the fundamental point we've seen from all of the shootings and all of these other mass things that have occurred is a bad guy with a gun who's intent on killing people will be stopped only by a good guy with a gun.
Hey, thank you, Jeff. Nice to talk to you this morning. Stan is next. Hi, Stan.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I would like to. Good morning, Judge. I would like to have two comments, if I could.
Sure.
But first, I'd like to engage you on your premise that the jail population is not biased towards blacks, and your statement is flawed without additional information. You made the statement that there are only 50 or so females in
15% was the female population.
Okay, 15% was the female population. Now, that statement by itself is flawed unless you break that down into people of color versus white people. Without making that distinction, you can't say that because 15% of the population is female and 51% of the population is male, there is no prejudicial incarceration of people of color.
Are you suggesting that white women aren't committing crimes?
Not at all.
Then why aren't they in jail?
White women are much more likely to be able to make bond. Because they have more money. That's the first thing.
How about people in prison where bond isn't an issue? Are white women in prison to the same extent of their percentage in the population?
Well, of course they aren't.
Why not?
Because people of color are less likely to be able to afford a lawyer. So they have to have a court-appointed lawyer, and court-appointed lawyers are historically unable to win cases.
More bunk. I've been in the criminal justice system for 50 years. Total bunk. The public defender's office does an excellent job, and they frequently do a better job than private counsel.
How many of the people in jail have had public defenders as opposed to the people in jail that have had hired lawyers?
Well, I don't know what the numbers are. There's a lot more people who are represented by public defenders, but I think, as a matter of fact, the public defender may be as or more successful in getting acquittals than the private bar.
I think the words "I think" define that statement. You need to have data.
Well, you asserted that public defenders can't get the job done. I'm telling you, from 50 years' experience, it's bunk.
The majority of public defenders do a great job. I agree with you on that. But the majority of people that have public defenders as opposed to private lawyers, many more of them end up in jail than people with private lawyers. And that's not a defensible, my statement is totally true.
So white women aren't in prison to match their numbers because they have been defended by private counsel, been able to get them off? That's your position?
Well, let's go. Let's not just make it white women. Let's make it everybody.
Well, let's make it women. People. Women are 50%. How come they're only about 15% in prison as well? Where are the other 35%? What happened to them?
The people that can afford a private lawyer are much more likely to not go to jail than the people that have public defenders.
Well, I want to just make sure I understand your position. Your position is that women are committing crimes in the same number as men, but they're just being able to beat the rap. Is that the case?
I didn't say that.
Well, I'm asking, is that your position?
No, it's not. Women are less likely to commit crimes because women are women, and they're wired differently than men.
So you mean there are differences among sexes?
Absolutely.
But there are no differences among races as far as their commission of crimes.
Didn't say that.
Well, I'm asking, are there?
I didn't say that.
I'm asking you. Tell me.
There are much more likely to have crimes committed by poor people than people are that are wealthy. If you just took the population of people that are on welfare, you're going to find that those criminality rates are very, very close to the population of the country. But if you take a look at the criminality rate of everybody, since whites are much more likely to have more money than blacks, you are going to have more blacks in jail than whites because they can't afford the lawyers.
Okay, Stan, I believe we've heard both sides of the story. Appreciate your call this morning. We need to take a break here at 10:51. We'll come back after that and have another 5 minutes or so. If you have a question or a comment for Justice Robert Steigman, give us a call. We're coming right back. We're back on Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin with Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. Couple of quick notes here, Bob, on the topics that we were on. There's been a community town hall meeting scheduled for January 17th. The topic there is gun violence in our community. And the Urbana City Council was briefed last night on racism. Racism research done by a university professor.
Gee.
It never stops.
No, no. And it will be more of the same. I mean, just look at these numbers, Jim. That's proof of racism. And, of course, you know, I'm wondering, did anyone ever ask at this Urbana City Council meeting, well, can officers tell the race of the driver of a car before they stop it? I'd like to hear someone from the audience say, oh, yeah, sure, that's proof of racism. Well, I don't think that's a defensible position. I don't think they can tell, and I think they're stopping cars essentially based upon what they assess to be violations of traffic laws or otherwise.
The other day I was pulled up at a stop sign, and the car pulled up next to me, and it had tinted windows. And I thought, wow, I couldn't even tell who was in the car. And then I began to watch for tinted windows, and I didn't realize there's quite a few of them. That would make a police problem a lot greater when
sure.
they come walking up there. They have no idea if it's a black, white, or who.
And that's during the day. And at night, you know, I mean, it's just silly to suggest that they
thought tinted windows might be against the law.
I thought it was too, but apparently it's something that is difficult to enforce, and I think it's just hard, so they may not be doing it.
One quick thing. I'll give you the last word. You got a couple of minutes here.
Yeah, a couple of things. We talked about Supreme Court justices in the past and what does it make a difference. There was a recent speech where Justice Gorsuch offered some important words about and demonstrates the difference in judicial philosophies. He said, words of wisdom for the rest of the judiciary. He says, judges should wear robes, not capes. And, you know,
that's a good statement.
We're not superheroes designed to right all the wrongs. We are limited in our roles as judges to carry out the law as written by the executive branch of government.
And I take that step one more step by saying, take off those robes and come to radio stations and talk to the people just as you've done for all these years.
Well, thank you. I like to think it's been a public service. Last regard, I've always been a great one to, as you know, say Merry Christmas. I'm a Merry Christmas kind of guy.
Yes, you are.
So I want to mention that to you and talk about what a pleasure it's been all these years to be working with you, Jim. This has been terrific. I appreciate this opportunity you've provided me, and I remember one of our favorite movies, It's a Wonderful Life with James Stewart, mm-hmm. and how at the end, and I was thinking that of all the people whose lives you've enriched and blessed, and of your many friends and admirers, the line that comes from that movie is, Jim Turpin, the richest man in town.
Well, you're very kind. I must tell you, it's been my pleasure. And, you know, not only having you on, but having Judge McCuskey and all the other law enforcement people that are kind enough to come on. I think it's a, I don't know if it's a duty or not, but it's certainly a helpful to people like me and people running talk shows to have a person like you, especially on the show for so many years. So it's been my pleasure.
Thank you, Jim.
Our time is up. The news is next here on WDWS in Champaign-Urbana.